genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turn down to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Hi, this is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're on Everyday Live, Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock here on KKZZ AM 1400, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. You can also hear us streaming over the internet at brainstormingonline.com. My goal is to bring you interviews with thought leaders in business, entertainment, sports, and the local community. Together, we'll listen to what these people say and relate it to how we live and work right here in Ventura County. If all of this sounds like National Public Radio, well, you're getting the idea. Brainstorming with Billy the Brain is NPR done right. If you want to join in the conversation, you can always call us at 639-0008, or if you're outside of the area code, it's area code 805-639-0008. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is radical thinking. Each of my guests will talk about some radically different way of looking at things. My first guest has information that may come as a surprise to many of us living here in Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. He claims that living in cities is better for us than living in paradise like we do. We'll examine the benefits of geographic proximity as we discuss his latest book, Triumph of the City. My second guest is a maverick who burst onto the scene several years ago with a manifesto for challenging conventional wisdom and showcasing the power of business at its best. He goes radical in his business thinking and his latest book, Practically Radical. We'll discuss the new business paradigms to transform your company, shake up your industry, and challenge yourself. My third guest has written the history of one of the country's leading publications of progressive feminine thinking, Cosmopolitan Magazine. We'll discuss the improbable first century of Cosmopolitan to learn that the magazine has gone through many iterations before becoming the bastion of female empowerment. And as always, if you want to join us, you can call us at 639-0008. Ed Glazer is the Fred and Eleanor Glimp Professor of Economics at Harvard University, where he also serves as the director of the Tobin Center for State and Local Government and the Rappaport Institute for Greater Boston. He studies the economics of cities and has written scores of urban issues, including growth of cities, segregation, crime, and housing markets. He's been particularly interested in the role that geographic proximity can play in creating knowledge and innovation. Ed received his PhD from the University of Chicago in 1992 and has been at Harvard ever since. Welcome to the show, Ed. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you on. We love having thought leaders like yourself on. So let's dive into it, shall we? For this is the first time in human history where more than half of the world's population now lives in a city. So go ahead and state your case. In what ways do cities help us advance as humans and humanity?
Absolutely. So my book challenges the notion that cities are decaying and corrupt and challenges the notion that the American dream can only be found behind a white picket fence in the suburb. And the core argument about why cities are so important is that they play to humankind's greatest asset, which is our ability to learn from people around us. We come out of the womb with this remarkable ability to just soak up information from the people that we're exposed to. And cities create an onrush of experience that in some sense educates us. It's not that everything that we learn in the city is good, but we learn from the screw-ups as well as from the successes. And that's what we see in the data. It's not just that there's a huge productivity premium associated with being in a city. After all, if the rest of the country were as productive as the New York metropolitan area, national GDP would increase by 43%. But that productivity premium occurs year by year. Every year that you come to a city, you get faster wage growth, which is, I think, associated with the learning that goes on in cities. And this is particularly important in the developing world, where cities are really pathways out of poverty into prosperity and places where people actually, you know, learn to be part of the global economy. That being said, given that I'm talking to people who are, as you said, are living in paradise, I'm not arguing that anyone who actually lives in Ventura should actually move to New York or move to Chicago. I think there are great reasons why people live in Ventura and that they, you know, many of them are very happy as a result. But it's important that we don't have public policies that stack the deck against cities, so that people should be free to choose where they want to live without a government that tries to privilege one type of living over another.
Wow, Ed, there's a lot of information in that last answer, and we will come back to some of the public policies that you espouse. We'll also come back and talk about emerging countries, but I want to drill down a little bit deeper, if I can, on your central thesis, which is that cities, you know, connect us as human beings in ways that living in the country or living in the suburbs can't. But what about the other inherent problems of crime, poverty, homelessness, poor education, congestion? I mean, you know, these are urban ills that we got to live with, whether you're in Los Angeles or New York or Chicago or any of the major metropolitan areas. So talk to me about some of the downsides,
Let's talk about that. So first of all, there are two things that are involved in your question, which is a great question, but one of which is urban poverty. And one of the points that I make in the book, I have a chapter on this, is that urban poverty is actually a sign that cities are succeeding, not a sign that cities are failing. Because cities don't make people poor. Cities attract poor people. Cities from Mumbai to Chicago attract poor people by providing economic opportunity, by providing the ability to, you know, work together with people with more skills, more ideas, more of an ability to make their labor productive. Indeed, you know, in America today, we have lots of people who are unemployed in far-flung metropolitan areas. And in some sense, there's a mismatch between labor and entrepreneurship, and that's a big problem that cities have historically managed to solve. Also, obviously, within the U.S., many of our cities have lower-cost housing than you see in, say, places like Ventura. And also, cities have the ability to get around without a car for every adult, which, let's say, many poor immigrant families actually value. So the fact that cities have poverty is not intrinsically a sign that cities are failing. In fact, it's a sign that cities are actually providing something good for an important segment of the population. Now, that being said, there are downsides to density that you correctly pointed to. If I'm close enough to exchange an idea with someone face-to-face, we're also close enough to exchange a contagious disease. And if, you know, somebody's close enough to sell me a newspaper, they're probably also close enough to rob me. So cities for millennia have had to battle the demons that come with density. But by and large, the cities have actually been, the cities of the developing world, the cities of the developed world, the wealthy cities have been successful in this. So a boy born in New York City in 1900 could expect to live 7 years less than the national average. A boy born in New York today can expect to live almost 2 years longer than the national average. I mean, that's been a radical change in, say, the healthiness of the cities. That didn't happen overnight. That required massive investments in particularly clean water. And New York becoming a safe place to live again required massive investments in crime prevention. So this was not cheap. But cities at the start of the 20th century were spending as much on water as the national government spent on everything except for the post office and the army. But the result of that was that cities ended up being relatively healthy and relatively safe. And indeed, the lower mortality rates for people living in New York, particularly among younger people, are fairly easy to understand. There are two major causes for death among younger people that are just lower in big cities, and one of them is deaths from motor vehicle accidents. You know, taking the subway after a few drinks is just a lot safer than driving drunk. And secondly, there are suicides, and there are just significantly lower suicide rates in dense urban areas, perhaps because of more social connection, or perhaps because there's just less of a culture of let's say, firearm availability. There's certainly a strong connection between hunting licenses per capita and teen suicides that suggests that there may be something to do with gun availability and suicides. So it took a lot of work, but it's a mistake to think of cities as being New York of 1875, where crime and disease are endemic, and you really want to think about a city that is as much fun to play in as it is productive.
All right. We're talking to Ed Glaser, everybody. His book, Triumph of the City, How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. Boy, again, a lot of information in that answer, Ed. Thank you so much for that. I want to come back to something that you talked about before, which was emerging markets. Now, China has over 200 cities with a million people or more. Just by contrast, the United States has 9 cities. And this is a shout-out to all of my listeners. If you call in and tell Tom Spence what are the 9 cities in the United States that have population of more than a million people, you can win a gift certificate for 4 free sandwiches or 4 free salads from Urbane Cafe, their new location at 1700 East Gonzales Road. So the number is 639-0008 if you want to call in and tell us what are the 9 cities with more than a million people. Back to the question, though, Ed. China has 200 cities with more than a million. The United States has 9. China should be extolling the virtues of city living, but, you know, you look at China, things are not so rosy in the Chinese cities as well. So let's use China as sort of a barometer for the rest of the emerging world, and talk to us how your theory applies in China and the rest of the emerging world.
Sure. So you're absolutely right. The Chinese cities have lots of problems, even more evident in India. I discussed the Dharavi slum, which was for a while the largest slum in Asia, in the book, which has, on one level, it's full of the glories of entrepreneurship. It's full of smart people trying to figure out new ways to make a buck. On the other hand, there's no clean water. Kids are defecating in the streets. It's a mess. And there certainly are difficult things in Chinese cities as well. But the important thing is that is to not benchmark those cities by what we're used to, whether or not we're sitting in Boston or sitting in Ventura County, because that just isn't an option for India right now. The option is for the people living in India, whether or not they're going to live in rural poverty with its unending infant mortality and disease and economic stasis, or whether or not they're going to accept the change that comes from urbanization. So while it's certainly true that China is, China has lots of problems, it certainly was in a much worse shape when it was a highly rural country. If you compare countries that are more than 50% urbanized with countries that are less than 50% urbanized, the infant mortality rates are one-third the level in the cities that are in the countries that are more than 50% urban, and incomes are more than five times higher in the countries that are more than 50% urban. So even though the cities have their problems, they're really the best path that we know out of poverty into prosperity. And the key response to those problems is to not think that we should stop these cities from growing, but to try and figure out better public policies that manage the downsides that come with density.
All right. Well, let's turn our attention back to the United States, Ed, if we can, and explain why Rust Belt cities like Detroit, Cleveland, St. Louis, Erie, Pennsylvania, et cetera, went into decline if city living is such a powerful force.
Right. So what happened in the industrial cities was that they lost touch with the things that make cities most dynamic in the long run. So if you go back to the early 19th century, the things that made for successful cities were smart people, small firms, and connections to the outside world. Those are still the three forces that make cities most productive today. And they were the things that actually led to the successes of Detroit in the early 20th century. So you go back to Detroit in 1904. It looks a lot like Silicon Valley did in the 1960s. There's a genius entrepreneur on every street corner. They're the Fisher brothers, the Dodge brothers, David Dunbar Buick, Henry Ford himself, Billy Durant in nearby Flint, a remarkable set of entrepreneurs, all of whom are supplying each other with goods, with ideas, with financing, all of whom are borrowing each other's notions and trying to come up with a new thing. And they did it. And they came up with this amazing thing, the mass-produced automobile that then provided untold benefits for millions of people throughout the world. And yet they did it in a way that was fundamentally antithetical to urban connections, to the things that make cities special. When Ford built the Rouge, the Great River Rouge plant, right, he built a massively, wholly contained, vertically integrated factory, walled off from the outside world, and providing, God bless him, providing jobs for ordinary Americans with less education. Well, all of a sudden, you went from a city of small firms, smart people, and connections to the outside world, with a city of a vast industrial factory with less general skills and less connections to the outside world, and that lost the whole value of cities. It lost the whole value of urban interactions. And when the changes in the economy happened, so the transportation costs fell, and it was possible to make those cars and right to work states or the outside world, Detroit couldn't come back. The fact that only 12% of the population in Detroit have a college degree makes it very, very difficult for the city to reinvent itself, because there's no variable that better predicts the ability of cities to come back after tough times than the skill level, that people with more education are just able to utilize urban density and the same proximity that once enabled hogsheads to be put on clipper ships now spreads spreads new ideas and enables urban reinvention.
All right. We're talking to Ed Glaser, everybody, his book, Triumph of the City. Ed, let's turn our attention to the role, either good or bad, that city government plays in a city's triumph.
Great question. So, Cities actually need governments, and we've talked already about the difficulties of dealing with the downsides of density. Cities require public services. So many cities in the U.S. were hit with yellow fever epidemics late 18th century. And Philadelphia and New York decided to go on two different paths. Philadelphia had a public water work that actually functioned fairly well. New York, through a fairly dangerous combination of Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton, of course Burr would have mentioned kill Hamilton,
right.
Burr hired Hamilton to be his lawyer and to make the case to the Federalist City Council that public water works would create burdensome taxes. Now, who isn't against burdensome taxes? I certainly am. And the Federalists signed off on the idea of having a private water provision that would be subsidized with the ability to run a bank. Now, the problem is they created this entity, and it did a lot of banking, but it didn't provide much clean water, because, of course, there was a lot more money in banking than there was in clean water. It's still around as a bank. Its descendant is called J.P. Morgan Chase, which was once the Chase Manhattan Bank, which was once the Bank of the Manhattan Water Company. Did a lot of banking, very successful at that, but didn't do much in terms of water provision, and New York didn't get clean water until it built the Croton Aqueduct at huge expense. That type of thing is really important that city governments do. But when it comes to actually micromanaging innovation, mayors are just not good venture capitalists. It's very hard to figure out, you know, to duplicate from some central bureaucracy the magic that happens when private entrepreneurs figure out smart things. And so it's really important for city governments to stay focused on the basics of quality of life in urban areas, you know, safe streets, short commutes, good schools, and not try to micromanage change. And as you think about sort of what was the great failure of Detroit coming back, the tragedy was that we focused on physical infrastructure for Detroit, urban renewal in the 50s, a people mover, a monorail, transportation infrastructure later on. Now, declining cities already have a lot of structures relative to people. They already have empty roads. The last thing Detroit needed was a people mover to glide over essentially empty streets. What it needed was more investments in the children of Detroit, when the human capital is ultimately the bedrock of urban success.
All right, we're talking to Ed Glaser, author of the book Triumph of the City, How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. So, Ed, give us your policy prescriptions for city living, if you will.
So there's only a little bit, apart from the things that you've heard, about what I'm actually recommending to city governments. I do believe in the values of more competition at the city level, and I'll just make two comments about that, one of which is the need to have fewer limitations on building up in urban cores. That I think too many cities, some of them in California, some of them in the East Coast, and many of them in Europe, have made space artificially expensive by constraining building. The other comment I would make that's really important is that cities succeed by harnessing the powers of competition and entrepreneurship. And, you know, that's what makes restaurants great in L.A. or San Francisco, right? Lots of guys starting new firms. But we've turned that off in schools. It's like we've handed over schools to a single, you know, single public monopoly, which has lost all of that. So we really need more competition in our schools. At the federal level, we need to reverse those policies that are deeply anti-urban, like the home mortgage interest deduction that basically bribes people out of urban apartments into single-family detached dwellings in the suburbs, like our, you know, massive subsidization of highways. Every new highway that cut into an urban core in post-war America reduced, on average, that urban core's population by 18% relative to the metropolitan area. And, of course, we do need to rethink our system of local schooling.
Wow, it's like drinking from a fire hose, everybody. We've been talking to Edward Glaser, author of the book Triumph of the City, How Our Greatest Inventions Make Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. Ed, if people like the sound of what you're saying and they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Oh, www.triumphofthecity.com.
Triumphofthecity.com. Ed, thank you so much for being our special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy Drain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks.